It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a growing trend of in-school mental health services in Wisconsin. We'll talk with an organizer of one of the first such programs in the state.
First, Wisconsin is no stranger to the national political spotlight, and the floodlights are on today with two political stars campaigning for Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke on the same day.
First Lady Michelle Obama was in Milwaukee this afternoon with Mary Burke, and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was in Hudson this morning with Scott Walker.
This kind of political star power speaks to the intensity of the race. With little over a month left before elections, the latest Marquette University poll shows each with 46% of the vote and 5% undecided. Poll director Charles Franklin called the race a statistical dead heat, and the LA Times has billed Wisconsin's gubernatorial race as the tightest in the country.
Here with us to talk about the Walker and Burke campaigns and the significance of today's national attention, we have Marcy Stetch. She's National Press Secretary for Emily's List. And Brian Nemoir, a Wisconsin-based political consultant and president of Full Impact Communications. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. We have a great show. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks. And Marcy, thanks to you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, Marcy, let's start with you. What impact does this kind of outside attention, a first lady, a renowned governor from another state, what does this do to a state race like ours in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it shows exactly how important and how exciting this race is right now. It really is a dead heat in the polls right now. And I think having this outside attention just really shows just how important this race is to Democrats overall. But I think at the heart of it all is that, you know, we all recognize both in the state of Wisconsin and outside of the Wisconsin that that families deserve better than what Scott Walker has put forward. So it really gives us an opportunity as Democrats to make sure that voters in the state know the stakes and know that there is a clear choice in this election, and Mary Burke has a plan to move forward. And make sure that women, families, everyone across the state has an opportunity to be part of an economy that works for all.
And Brian, Marcy's saying Democrats around the country have their eyes on this one. Same true for Republicans around the nation?
Well, I think that is true. And I'm always amused when people from outside of the state seem to know what's best for Wisconsin. This is a tight race. I don't think it surprises anyone. And in the coming weeks, both candidates are going to try to do things to distinguish themselves. And sort of try to garner some traction. We've seen the last couple of weeks Mary Burke do things like plagiarize jobs plans to try to garner attraction. We see Scott Walker forging ahead, talking about his record and bringing in other successful governors. If you look across the country, it's really governors who have set the tone for progress, put forth the greatest innovations, and done things that Washington, D.C. has often begged, borrowed, and stolen from. And Wisconsin's a great example of that, whether it be W-2, school choice. We are the birthplace of great innovation. It doesn't surprise me we've got other great governors joining Scott Walker.
And Brian, do you think having outside figures like this, whether it's a Chris Christie or a Michelle Obama, do Wisconsin voters pay attention? Is that going to influence anybody to go out and vote?
Well, I don't know if they do or don't pay attention. I'm not one to say that someone doesn't have a voice in an election. But I think at the end of the day, people are going to take a look at these two candidates, and the contrast couldn't be greater. You've got a guy who has put forth a plan, pushed Wisconsin in the right direction, reversed the trends of Mary Burke and Jim Doyle, our past governor, and the jobs we lost and the bad budgets that they set forth. And it's put forth a plan. I think when people look at the end of the day and see what the content is, these two candidates just don't compare.
And Marcy, same question for you. Do those outside figures move the needle here?
Well, I think it absolutely reminds voters, again, what's at stake in this election. And I'm sorry, I just can't agree. Governor Walker has brought this state to dead last in the Midwest when it comes to job creation. He has had 4 years to put forward to try and meet his promises of 250,000 jobs created, and he has fallen far short of that. There is a $1.8 billion shortfall in the Wisconsin governor in the Wisconsin state budget. And it's all Scott Walker's fault. He's asking for a promotion, but really he should be fired. And I think that at the end of the day, we have an opportunity in front of us to make sure that voters know that there is a different direction that this state can go. they can move themselves from being dead last in the Midwest and John Creation with the leadership of Mary Burke. And furthermore, I think it's interesting, you know, bringing in Governor Christie for this. You know, Chris Christie and Scott Walker have quite a bit in common. And I think you kind of have to look at them. And, you know, they're both kind of got their eye on 2016, thinking maybe that'll be something that they are both interested in. But they've been really advancing these extreme agendas in both of their states, in Wisconsin and New Jersey, rather than focusing on boosting the economy and creating jobs. And we can see that today, again, with Wisconsin being last in the Midwest in job creation, but New Jersey being 48th in the entire country in job creation. So Chris Christie does not have a story to tell when it comes to stimulating the economy, and I certainly think that's a story that he'd want to keep out of the state of Wisconsin with Scott Walker's record.
And Brian, let's bring you in on this last in jobs issue. We've seen different rankings and different reports, with the quarterly reports showing Wisconsin low in the Midwest anyway. How do you tackle the jobs issue?
Well, there's a bunch of ways you can slice those numbers. I think it's plain to see that Wisconsin has grown jobs. The two areas in Wisconsin where job growth has fallen a little bit behind is Milwaukee and Madison. And those are both areas that are run by Democrats and have long time been Democrat strongholds. While it's interesting to point to Chris Christie, I think it's more notable to point to why Mary Burke didn't bother to see our president. He's in town a few short weeks ago on Labor Day. You know, it's perhaps the one guy who has lower approval ratings than Mary Burke does right now. And instead they fly in his wife, the first lady, to help out their gubernatorial candidate.
Is this meaningful that Mary Burke didn't appear on stage with President Obama, Marcy?
Look,
meant to throw that one to Marcy, Brian.
Yeah, well, I think that it was pretty clear that was an official White House visit, and Mary Burke was very clear about, you know, her obligations for the day. But the president, I believe, has committed to coming to Wisconsin to make sure that voters know the stakes in this election. I don't think that at the end of the day, this isn't about surrogates. It comes down to what's happening in the state of Wisconsin. And I guess, you know, we keep going back to the bottom line here, and that is that Scott Walker has had 4 years of leadership in that state that has just completely failed, and he's missed the mark on so many levels. So the more that voters hear that, from whether that be the president, whether it be first from Cecile Richards, who's the president of Planned Parenthood, who's coming in next week to speak to Wisconsin voters, you know, we need to make sure that voters get to the polls in November, and that is the best opportunity to bring these outside voices and remind people what's exactly at stake as we get to the final days here in this election.
I want to throw negative news at each of you about the candidate you support. Marcy, first of all, and Brian mentioned this earlier, the campaign material, the jobs plan, non-original wording. Some have said plagiarism, some have used kinder words. Is this a problem for Mary Burke?
Well, let's take a step back and look at exactly where these attacks are coming from. Again, I don't need to remind you again where the state is in job creation, but these attacks were coming from Scott Walker and his Republican allies, you know, 36 days before the election. It's an attempt to distract from the real issues that are at stake right now. And I think Mary Burke has a very strong vision for where she needs to take the state. She knows that things like a higher minimum wage, investing in students, investing in low-wage jobs and good-paying jobs across the state will be the right way forward for the state. So I think at the end of the day, these are just an attempt that Scott Walker is going to try and distract from the voters. But she's got the right ideas in mind. She's got a vision to take the state forward, and nothing's going to stop her until moving forward.
And Brian, I want to throw the John Doe 2 investigation. Just recently, a circuit court of appeals, federal court of appeals, lifted a stay on that back in the state courts. Is that going to be a liability for Governor Walker in this race?
I prefer to talk about Mary Burke's plagiarism, but having asked that question, I will say this. The John Doe has been around, is not going away. I think fair-minded people recognize that it's politically motivated, has no end because, quite frankly, the folks that are pushing it have no desire for it to end, and I doubt it'll be an issue in this campaign. If you are running for governor in Wisconsin, you're going to stake your claim on the fact that you can grow jobs. You better have done it in the past, and Mary Burke hasn't done that as Commerce Secretary, and you better make sure that your jobs plan is truly your own work and is it embodies the integrity that you hope to bring to the office. And quite frankly, Mary Burke has failed on both accounts.
We're talking with Mary Stetch. She's National Press Secretary of Emily's List. And Brian Niemar. He's Wisconsin-based political consultant and president of Full Impact Communications. Both First Lady Michelle Obama and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie were in Wisconsin today campaigning for Mary Burke and Scott Walker, respectively.
We're back with Marcy Stetch, National Press Secretary of Emily's List, and Brian Niemar, Wisconsin-based political consultant and president of Full Impact Communications. Both First Lady Michelle Obama and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie were in Wisconsin today campaigning for Mary Burke and Scott Walker, respectively.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Does this national political star power sway anyone here in Wisconsin? Do you think national politics in general have an impact on who wins the race for governor? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Paul on the line in Green Bay. Paul, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make one comment. We're talking about something that is extremely complicated. People have put their lives into figuring out how the economy works, and I don't think that one person's failure to not be able to create jobs should be all put on one person's shoulder. The economy is such a diverse, ever-changing, dynamic thing that I don't think anybody should be saying that their plan is going to work.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. So whether their name's Jim Doyle, Scott Walker, Mary Burke, you name it, there's a national economy, an international economy. Brian, we'll start with you. Do governors really have that much control over the jobs and the economy in their state?
Well, I think what governors do is create the right environment. And if you take a look at the record of Scott Walker's predecessor, Jim Doyle, versus our current governor has gone out of his way to make sure we've got a strong working environment in Wisconsin where businesses can thrive and flourish, whether it be cutting regulation, whether it be reducing taxes, whether it be providing workforce training dollars. Scott Walker has clearly stated that Wisconsin's open for business. It's not an overnight solution. It's going to take some time. But as you talk to CEOs across the state and you measure confidence level, people are confident this state is heading in the right direction and believe that turning back the clock isn't the right way for us to go.
Marcy?
Well, yeah, I absolutely believe that that governors do have the power to make sure that there's a competitive and business-friendly environment. But what Scott Walker has done, he has moved the state backwards. You look at all the other states in the Midwest. I mean, I'm from Minnesota. I grew up there, and neighbors just to the west of Wisconsin, it's a completely different story to tell. So he has made some decisions as governor that have made the state less competitive when it comes to job creation. I point you to rejecting the Medicaid expansion. That was a purely political decision by Scott Walker that has made women, families in the state of Wisconsin, made them have to pay for it out of their own pocket. Again, that $1.8 billion budget shortfall that Wisconsin's seeing right now is not because of, anything that Scott Walker inherited. It's because he's put his own extreme policies and his own ideology above what's best for the families in Wisconsin.
Back to our callers now with Catherine and Lac du Flambeau. Catherine, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Catherine?
Actually, I thought of a couple things after I mentioned the issue that nobody is mentioning. Scott Walker and his dealings with the Koch brothers and GTAC, the selling out of Wisconsin, but also through the DNR with his head there, the selling out of the lands, the wetlands, and then the hunting issues where all this hunting's being opened up that isn't natural.
All right, Catherine, thanks for the call. Marcy, we'll start with you this time. I'm guessing you might not argue with her. She's worried about the the donations to Scott Walker and particular business and environmental issues.
That's right. Well, I think Scott Walker has a lot of buddies, in the Karl Rove and the Koch brothers and several other conservative right-wing leaders in this country who basically want to have him in their own pocket so that they can advance their own agendas. So I think that that's definitely true. And I think when we look at some of the other policies that Scott Walker has prioritized, we see his work that he's done to repeal the state's only equal pay law for women in the state. Now, Wisconsin is one of only 5 states in the entire country to not have equal pay protections for women. The work he did to advance mandatory ultrasounds in the dead of night, now making that part of a women's health plan in the state of Wisconsin, which is completely backward. He's against minimum wage, which, again, impacts women in the state of Wisconsin in an unfair balance. So I think that Scott Walker has a laundry list of entire policies that are completely wrong for women, and it spans beyond just the work he's done on the economy, but I do think it does span and impact women in particular in the state of Wisconsin.
And Brian, your response to the caller and to Marcy.
I'm not sure if I sensed the question in that caller. I just sensed there was more of a bunch of opinions. I think Scott Walker is stating his claim on putting Wisconsin in a better place to grow jobs. That's going to involve some proactive measures and some strong principles. I don't think anyone could argue that our governor isn't independent and doesn't put forth a plan and doesn't charge forward based on that plan. And that's what he's going to be running on, and I think that's what's going to get him elected in November.
I want to bring up Act 10. It's been a few years now. It was a huge thing in Wisconsin politics, brought us up in large part to a recall election a couple years ago. Governor Christie mentioned it today. Marcy, starting with you, does Act 10 still matter? The union laws still matter here in this election?
Well, I think making sure that you've got someone in that governor's office who's looking out for all workers is important. I think Mary Burke is the right person to make sure that folks across the state, union members, everyone has their voice at the table. And Scott Walker has been completely opposite of that. So I do think it is a factor, but I think right now everyone wants to talk about moving forward. And Scott Walker is asking for his promotion, but he just really needs to understand that he's had his time and it's time for someone new who has the right vision.
And Brian, is Act 10 a pro for Governor Walker in this campaign?
Well, I'll have to say that Marcy and I finally agree on something. I do think that Act 10 does matter. It does matter to the 30 or 25% of hardcore Democrats out there that still wrap themselves in union protections. The rest of the state is looking at the savings that Act 10 has produced and has looked at the rules that we put in place that most folks in the normal workplace have to deal with and say, yeah, so what? You got to play by the same rules that all employees and employers do, number one. And number two, it saved us billions of dollars of tax money. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a win. So if you look at Act 10 merely as the word Act 10, yeah, it certainly will create some animosity amongst the right people. But if you look at Act 10 and what it delivered, it's a win across the board.
Running low on time now, I want to ask each of you a similar question. Neck and neck, as we said at the outset, a very close race. Brian, what does Governor Walker need to do over the next month to win?
Well, I think the governor needs to keep reminding people of what he's done to help turn this state around. And it's not just Act 10. It's the job situation we are. Unemployment is lower than it was 4 years ago, number one. Our budget for the state is in better shape than it was 4 years ago, number two. And number three, we're growing jobs in the state. And I think if he talks about those things in the coming weeks, while it probably won't be a walkaway huge win, it will be a win, which is where I expected things to be.
And Marcy, same question. Mary Burke, what does she need to do between now and Election Day?
Mary Burke's got to keep doing what she's doing. She's doing a fantastic job traveling around the state. She's put over 50,000 miles on her Ford Escape traveling around the state to talk about what really matters to Wisconsin families right now. And I think she's got the right message, the right experience to move the state forward. And I think that what we can see in the polling and what we can hear on the ground and see at these rallies is just voters could not be more excited about a new voice, someone with the right priorities in office, and she's just got to keep telling that story.
It's going to be a lively conversation for the next month. Marcy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian, thanks to you as well.
Rob, great show. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Marcy Stetch. She's National Press Secretary of Emily's List, and Brian Niemoyer. He's a Wisconsin-based political consultant. He's also president of Full Impact Communications. We had both First Lady Michelle Obama and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in Wisconsin campaigning for the respective candidates. And by the way, lively conversation. You could still keep it going over at the Central Time Facebook page. Share your thoughts over there as always. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR to let us know your thoughts a little more than a month out from Election Day. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, is it possible that technology could actually make us less capable of handling life for ourselves? We explore that question later on.
First, we're talking about a growing trend in Wisconsin schools providing in-house mental health services. Some state school districts are national leaders when it comes to school mental health programs.
One of the first adopters of such a program is the Menasha Joint School District. Here to talk about that program and how it's changed things for students in the Fox Valley is Mary Wisnett. She's a program officer for United Way Fox Cities. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So the program in Fox Valley Schools, it's called United Way's Path for Students. What's the idea behind it?
Well, the idea is to eliminate barriers to care for kids who are unable to access care in the community. And one of the things that we found is that, unfortunately, there are barriers besides just financial barriers, which is really what you commonly think of when you think of why people aren't receiving medical services. But there's also transportation barriers, and there's parent work schedules that don't permit them to take time off work to take their child to an appointment in the community. So when we realized all of these barriers were impacting some of the statistics that we were seeing around our kids, we thought, well, if we can't bring the kids to the appointment, let's bring the appointment to the kids. And hopefully they're spending most of their time in school. So we started a school-based program in 2008, and we piloted it in the Menasha Joint School District just to see if it was going to work. And since then, it's had enormously successful results, and so we've expanded to 9 other school districts. So we are in 10 school districts and 23 different schools in the Fox Cities.
So you bring the mental health services to the students in the schools. How does it work?
Well, teachers or counselors may identify a student that is having some issues, and typically they would refer them to a clinic in the community. But if those students have barriers to care, as I mentioned before, then they'll refer them to the PATH program. And our licensed therapists are the very same kinds of therapists that a student might see in the community. They do have particular expertise in dealing with issues around children and adolescents. And so they come to the schools, and they provide the exact same level of service that they would at their home site.
Okay, and how did this program get started? What was the initiative?
Well, in the Fox Cities, we do a community assessment every 5 years. And in 2006, when the Life Study came out, that's the name of our assessment, we found some pretty startling data. We saw that 25% of our local 10th graders reported having experienced depression within the last 30 days. And even more startling, 14% said they had attempted suicide.
Hmm.
So the volunteers at United Way really wanted to look at that issue and figure out why kids weren't getting to the services in the community. And that's when they realized that there were barriers to care, and they developed the PATH program.
So you cited those statistics, 25% of kids experiencing depression, 14% having attempted suicide. Did those numbers start to turn around for you when PATH got implemented?
Well, yeah, I hesitate to say that we're the sole reason some of those numbers have turned around, but we have seen a bit of improvement. When the 2011 Life Study came out, we saw that 21% of students reported that they had experienced some form of depression in the last 30 days, and 10% had attempted suicide. So the numbers have gone down a little bit, but I would hesitate to take full credit for that,
mm-hmm.
Because our community has really come together to address mental health services on a community-wide level. So we are just one of the elements in the Fox Cities that's really working to address that problem.
Well, and how has it impacted the community as a whole?
Well, you know, I can certainly cite our outcome results, because we measure outcomes in two major areas. One is we certainly want the kids that we're taking care of to have improved mental health services and to have improved mental health. And then we also measure outcomes related to school performance. So if their grades have been suffering because of their mental health issues, are their grades now getting better? If they've had a lot of suspensions, detentions, unexcused absences, are those getting better because of their services? And when we can cite data, you know, about 72% of the kids are showing improved functioning and reduced symptoms as a result of PATH.
You can finish.
About 63% are showing improved school performance, both grades, improved grades, as well as improved school behaviors. But, you know, when you kind of get past all of the data, one of the easiest ways to explain success of the program is a quote from the principal of Menasha High School, Dr. Larry Hazy. When he was asked what was the benefit of the PATH program to Menasha High School, he said, "Without this program, these kids would not have graduated from high school." So I think, while there's lots of data and so on, that probably is the most meaningful piece of information, that we're giving kids the necessary coping skills so that they are able to be successful in school and then ultimately be successful in life.
So based on your experience with the program, would you say that this is something that should possibly adopted statewide?
We certainly think so, and we've also seen a lot of other communities that have seen some of the results of our program and have been approaching us to start a program in their community. We've been approached by Racine, by Sheboygan, by Waukesha, and as far away as Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So there certainly is a movement of individual communities to develop a program. But it would be wonderful if we could have some sort of state initiative that would really promote it for all communities, because really there are kids that are just falling through the cracks because they're not able to access very good services in the community, but they're just not able to get there.
How widespread is it? You mentioned your district, and I know there are some others, but how many schools would you say have it?
In our Fox Cities, we're in 23 buildings. We would love to be in every single school in the Fox Cities, but, you know, there's limited resources. So each district picks what schools they feel have the greatest need, and then those are the schools that we're serving right now. But I'm sure that there's, anytime you talk to a school professional, they will tell you, we would love to have PATH in our school too. So I think it's a pretty widespread issue. And, you know, some of the latest statistics we've seen is that anywhere from 20 to 25% of children and adolescents have some sort of mental health issue. So I think it is a pretty serious concern.
In terms of schools that might want to adopt it but see some barriers, one of them might be cost. How does the program get funded?
Right now, we are funding the program in two major ways. One is we bill third-party payers whenever possible. So if families have insurance coverage, if kids are on Badger Care, we certainly bill those. We work with licensed professional agencies, so they are all capable of billing third-party payers. But then we also rely heavily on philanthropic dollars. We've been very fortunate to get a grant from our local community foundation through a basic needs giving partnership that involves a number of foundations within the Fox Cities. And then United Way, of course, also supports the program.
Well, Mary, thanks so much for coming on and telling us about it.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Mary Wisnett, Program Officer for United Way Fox City. She was with us to talk about in-school mental health services offered in the Fox Valley, part of a growing trend here in Wisconsin. We live in a technological age where computers navigate our plane, show us how to get from points A to B, and help diagnose health problems.
Technology is allowing us to outsource lots of tasks that we simply don't have time for, but is it helping us in the long run? What do we sacrifice? What do we lose by allowing computers to run the errands, help us socialize, make decisions, and solve problems?
With us now is Deborah Blum, a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a columnist for the New York Times, and a blogger for Wired. She's also the author of The Poisoner's Handbook, and she edited the 2014 edition of the Best American Science and Nature Writing. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, one of the pieces in the Best American Science and Nature Writing, which you edited, is called The Great Forgetting. It's by Nicholas Carr. And it's about technology's impact on the way that we think, the way that we respond to things. What is it that we're likely to start forgetting now that we live in the age of apps and computers who can do just about everything for us? Sometimes it feels like.
Well, I love this car piece because it makes you think about the way our brains interact with sort of automation. And he uses some really interesting examples. He really starts with one that's kind of scary, which is he poses this question, what if pilots who are used to putting planes on autopilot forget how to fly, and what happens when the automation fails? So that's a good example of how we can become too dependent on automation. And as we do that, as he argues, our skills diminish and our brains turn off. And I mean, and I can give you an example of what happens when we become too dependent if you want.
Well, before we get to that, yeah. This is kind of an age-old argument. You think of the printing press, probably think people were saying similar things. The assembly line, is there something qualitatively different these days that's putting us more at risk?
Well, I think one of the points that Nicholas Carr makes is that our brains learn by acting. It makes perfect sense. You know, we train our brains. We put them through certain tasks. We sort of lay down neural pathways in which the next time you're in that situation, your brain says, oh, yeah, I know how to do that. But what if you're not training your brain? I mean, this is really the basis of his argument. You're not training your brain to think that way. You're not laying down the sort of, brain cell framework that's going to come back when you need it. You're just letting a machine do it for you. So when you're saying, okay, autopilot, fly my plane, or okay, GPS, make that map and I won't even bother and make a mental map, or okay, machine, do this for me, we're actually learning, we're actually losing skills and abilities, and I think kind of our sort of long history of engaging our brain, we lose some of that. And it's not necessarily catastrophic, but I like it because it makes perfect sense.
And you're right, there are some pretty harrowing examples in the car piece, certainly about flying airplanes. And it seems as that when the computers toss it back to the humans, the humans aren't able to do what they need to do in the right moment. What happens?
So he gave two examples of, speaking of catastrophic results, he gave two examples of planes that crashed. And in both cases, this was really fascinating to me. It was a situation where the instruments didn't work properly, or autopilot turns off when there's a problem. The planes are designed to say, okay, now there's a problem, we need some human judgment. Autopilot turns off, but the pilot is not used to making the decision and has not been actually training his brain to respond to these kind of situations. In this case, in two cases, the plane started slowing down and started to go down. And so the pilot responds by pulling up the nose of the plane, right? Let's get that plane up into a higher altitude. Well, when you pull up the nose of the plane, you're going against gravity and the plane will stall. And so in both of these cases, the planes went into stall mode, started to nosedive, and in one case they just couldn't figure out what was going on and never corrected. And in the other case, the pilot literally did not let go of the stick that was pulling the plane upward, and the plane was down in less than a minute, right? And later in the piece, he talks about the training of pilots, in which now the FAA is saying, you need to turn off all autopilot so pilots can actually train their brains to make judgment. And we have a concern that we're forgetting how to fly. And he raises the question, you know, Google car, the car that'll drive itself. What happens when we're all doing that? And what happens when, say, that computer dies? Will we know how to drive? Will our brains have that capacity? So it's, are we putting ourselves at risk by becoming too dependent, and are we becoming dumber?
But it seems like there's a trade-off. Maybe the normal case and the technology is working, it's actually safer. Say you see a lot of drivers on the road where you wish a computer was driving their car
right.
for them. And so the norm is safer enough that those exceptional occurrences don't balance it out and it's still a net positive.
Yes. And so, yeah, most of the time you can make an argument that autopilot has been much safer because people's attention drift. But it is always but if something works, you want the pilot to know what he's doing, right? And as we get more and more into this, are we going to put more and more people at risk? So, yeah, there is the argument for safety. I think that's a fair argument. I think there is also an argument that we still don't want to lose those skills. In that sense, the plane's an extreme example, right? I think about it more in my own life with GPS. I go down to Chicago to visit my son there. I don't have a clue what Chicago's like. I plug in the address and I go, and every once in a while I'll say to myself, where does my son live exactly? Mm-hmm. But I don't know. And I realize that if someone stole my phone or I broke it or something, I'd be hopeless. I could never navigate. I have no picture in my mind. I have no idea where he lives, right? So I've lost that ability to rescue myself. And at some level, we all want to maintain our ability to rescue ourselves from catastrophic situations.
And Nicholas Carr makes the point in his piece that we're kind of just at the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. We think that computers do so much, but really we've just begun to tiptoe through that door, and there's no telling what computers could eventually do for the human race, what they could take over in our day-to-day lives. Mm-hmm. Should we be worried about that and start preparing now?
Well, I don't feel like in a sci-fi sense. I mean, there's like arguments about artificial intelligence and whether, you know, in the kind of Stanley Kubrick way, eventually the automation will run us. But I do think that we can be smart about recognizing the risk. Like one of the points that Nicholas Carr makes is that in some programs now, they randomly just shut it off. You know, you're like sitting there, your plane's on autopilot, you're on autopilot, but what if you knew at some random point it was going to turn off? Then you would have to pay attention. And so his point is we have to figure out ways, even as automation increases, to keep ourselves engaged with the process and to keep ourselves part of the process. And I think he's right. I think we're smart enough to develop automation, and we're smart enough to get ahead of it.
You know, it seems like maybe a better approach is the human's in control and the technology is giving a nudge. And I'm thinking like mm-hmm. new cars that you can switch on a thing that says, hey, you just turn on your right turn signal. I'm detecting something over there. Maybe give an extra look so that we're still in control and the computer is alerting us to potential trouble.
That's a smart idea, because what you really want is to keep yourself engaged, right? So imagine that you had your car, you're driving your cool Google car, you're on autopilot, something, you know, some switch goes off and the car starts veering all over the road, but you weren't paying attention. So we've got to build into these systems like kind of checkpoints like you're talking about, hey, you. In which we're still engaged in the process. And also, you know, we want to be smart. We want our brains to work in all kinds of interesting ways. We want to keep all those complex neural pathways that make us who we are. And so the other thing to remember is, you know, there's things about the good old days in which you had to constantly think for yourself. Maybe you weren't always as perfect about it as a computer, but man, you were smart. We want to keep that.
Is it possible that the computers, though, they're just freeing us up to think about grander things, loftier things?
And writing so we can, white operas, yeah.
Right, so we can stay a step ahead of them?
You know, and that's one of the arguments for it. If we just automate everything, that we'll all, then we're all free to be complete geniuses.
Right.
I kind of love that. I'm still waiting for my genius moment, actually. But, you know, you could go back to something as simple as the washing machine. There was a big argument that when washing machines were invented, women would, and women did all the washing, so I'm using women, that they'd be freed up to go out and be geniuses and do other things. But the problem is, once you had a washing machine, then you washed your clothes more often. We got more used to being clean all the time. So pretty soon you're putting just as much time into laundry as you were when you only washed every 2 weeks when it was a big hassle, right? So you have to also think, what's the consequence of using this technology?
Do we think about what's the consequences of using this technology as a rule?
No, never. I think we just go, oh, this is so cool, let's do it. And I think we do that not just with technology, but with all kinds of next best things, right? I love this idea. And frankly, when I am driving around with my teenage son as he learns to drive, I'm like, where is that Google car? I just feel so much safer. So I'm going to be riding. I can't wait for it myself.
Now, briefly here, as we get towards the end of our time together, is this something that's just inevitable? Computers are going to get better. They're ascendant. We're descendant. And, you know, things are not looking good for us as a species in terms of intelligence and what we do. Is that part of what we just maybe have to make peace with?
You know, that's a good, I mean, I like to think that we're still, after I just trashed the idea that automation allows us to become more brilliant, I would like to think that we're going to continue to be smarter about this, that people like Nicholas Carr, who is a wonderful writer, and other people who think about it will say, oh, hello, you know, red flag, let's stop, let's think and be smart about where this is wanting to go so that we'll actually make some intelligent choices. Here's what we want this to do. Here's how we're going to make best use to it. And here's how we're going to remember that the human mind is still a wonderful thing and we want to take good care of it.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, Deborah.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That was Deborah Blum. She's a professor of journalism at UW-Madison. She's the author of The Poisoner's Handbook, and she edited the 2014 edition of The Best American Science and Nature Writing.